I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. When John Kasich answered last night's first question about his greatest weakness with a complaint about frontrunners Donald Trump and Ben Carson, it was clear that the third GOP presidential debate was not going to follow the script.
Good question, but I want to tell you, my great concern is that we are on the verge, perhaps, of picking someone who cannot do this job. I've watched to see people say that we should dismantle Medicare and Medicaid and leave our senior citizens out in the cold. I've heard them talk about deporting 10 or 11 people here from this country, out of this country, splitting families. I've heard about tax schemes that don't add up, that put our kids in a deeper hole than they are today.
The focus of the debate, hosted by CNBC, was supposed to be jobs and the economy. It included attacks on the moderators and the media, and the predicted fight between frontrunners Donald Trump and Ben Carson never materialized. In fact, they both kind of faded into the background. Jeb Bush had a lot on the line last night and got into a testy squabble with fellow Floridian Marco Rubio about his voting record in the Senate.
But Marco, when you signed up for this, this was a six-year term. And you should be showing up to work. I mean, literally, the Senate, what is it, like a French work week? You get like 3 days where you have to show up? You can campaign or just resign and let someone else take the job. There are a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck in Florida as well. They're looking for a senator that will fight for them each and every day.
I get to respond, right?
30 seconds.
30 seconds. Well, it's interesting. Over the last few weeks, I've listened to Jeb as you've walked around the country and said that you're modeling your campaign after John McCain. That you're going to launch a furious comeback the way he did by fighting hard in New Hampshire and places like that, carrying your own bag at the airport. You know how many votes John McCain missed when he was carrying out that furious comeback that you're now modeling it under?
He wasn't my concern.
No, Jeb, I don't remember. Well, let me tell you, I don't remember you ever complaining about John McCain's vote record. The only reason why you're doing it now is because we're running for the same position and someone has convinced you that attacking me is going to help you.
On today's edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times, we'll be talking about what the candidates had to say and didn't say last night and how their performances might influence GOP voters. Joining us are Ben Domenech. He's publisher of the Federalist and writes The Transom. That's a daily subscription email for political insiders. He's also a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. And Ben Domenech, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst for RealClearPolitics.com. Wrote a book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. And Sean Trendy's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You sound very tired.
Yeah, it was a long night last night.
Well, let me read, Sean, let me read a tweet that you you tweeted out last night. This was at 10:09 p.m. You said, "I watched this debate because I agreed to do radio tomorrow morning. I'm really PO'd right now." What made you so mad about last night's debate? This radio show today, but go ahead.
No, I'm actually happy to be here. But it was just a painful debate to watch. I mean, in a way, it was kind of fun to do because everyone on Twitter was ganging up left, right. You don't see that very often. But it was poorly moderated. The questions were needlessly, there's a fine line between a tough question and a rude question. I think they crossed that line. And they didn't do a good job of corralling the candidates. It was brutal.
So your focus really on just CNBC, the moderators, and what, losing control of the debate last night?
Well, it wasn't just losing control of the debate. It's the whole purpose of a Republican or Democratic debate is to inform the electorates about who the candidates are, help them make a choice between the candidates. And I didn't really learn anything about any of the candidates last night because so many of the questions really were kind of gotcha questions or trying to pit candidates against each other. I came out of the economic debate no wiser about what the candidates' economic plans are.
Ben, what did you learn last night, if anything?
You know, I have to agree with Sean's analysis. I think this was a debate where we learned relatively little about the candidates' positions. I do think that that moment that you played regarding Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio was a mistake on Bush's part. I think Rubio had a very good performance. If he didn't win the debate, it was probably Ted Cruz. But I think that in this context, Jeb has been convinced that he needs to fire away at somebody, and that's not really in his character. He's a gentleman. He's a nice guy. He's a bit of a nerd. And he's not someone who is natural at these kind of attacks on other candidates. I thought that that moment really did not accrue to his benefit. But in terms of the actual economic policies, we're talking about an economic debate in which there were no questions about Wall Street regulation. Mm. There were no questions about Too Big to Fail. There were no questions about this recent trade deal and what people thought of it. These are all major economic questions, and none of them were put to any of these candidates by these CNBC moderators. This was a debate in which there was no conservative media partner, which the RNC had previously said that they would require for every network that wasn't named Fox. In this case, I think that you saw the damage that could be done to the entire debate process by a group of moderators who didn't know how to corral the candidates, didn't let them talk when they started to talk about interesting things. Afterward, RNC chair Reince Priebus came out and made a very clear statement about how disappointed he was with the process. You've seen a number of moderate media analysts, people like Stu Rothenberg, mm-hmm. people like Larry Sabato, coming out and saying how terrible it was. And I really think that is a pretty big headline coming out of this debate.
Sean, and it's not the first debate with 10 or more candidates. Is part of the problem of corralling these candidates and trying to stick to the time schedule is that you can't do that with 10 people?
Well, I think it's time to start winnowing these debates down, absolutely. Someone made a point that, like, the undercard debate, you have four people speaking, and they probably got as much speaking time, if not more, than the top-line debate. So, it's tough, but we've also seen successes at corralling these candidates in the other debates that we've had. So it's kind of, I put part of it on just the format, and part of it, I really do think the moderators didn't do a very good job of it.
Ben, let me go back to you, and you were talking about Jeb Bush, and Sean, I'd like to hear from you as well. Is he cooked, do you think, Jeb Bush?
You know, it's hard to sort of...
go ahead, Ben, and then Sean will get you in.
Yeah,
gotcha.
It's hard to say if Jeb is really cooked when he has still the most money of anybody who's in the field. There was a pretty good interview with Mike Murphy, the head of his super PAC operation recently in Bloomberg, where he went through kind of the state of the race and why Jeb ultimately was playing the long game and really playing to win. The pressure you see now on him making a decision to get out is mostly coming from donors who have shifted from Jeb or from Scott Walker to Marco Rubio. And this echoes something that we saw play out among the Democrats in 2008, where a candidate, an inspirational young candidate in Barack Obama, who not a lot of people thought could feasibly be the nominee when he got into the race, suddenly became a lot more feasible and looked like someone who could actually be the Democratic nominee and make it to the White House. The same sort of thing is happening with Marco Rubio. And what we saw in 2008 was that money shifted very rapidly from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama over the course of a shorter period of time than people expected. I think the same thing's going to happen with Jeb and Marco, but I think that's why Jeb is cutting his operation back a little bit. He's trying to be a little more lean and mean. And I honestly do not believe that he will get out prior to people starting to vote.
Sean, 4 years ago, who was the leading Republican candidate at this time, this time 4 years ago?
It was either Giuliani or Thompson at this point. It was definitely, or 4 years ago, I think it was Herman Cain.
Yeah.
You know, so that tells us how late momentum really can build in these races and candidates come from out of nowhere.
But do you think it's about money? Sort of as Ben was saying, if you follow who's supporting who money wise, that might tell us who's banking on this long game?
No, because if you look at the candidates who have come from nowhere or rebounded in the last few cycles, you have candidates like John Kerry, who wasn't necessarily leading the money race in 2004, or John McCain in 2008. I mean, if money could buy the nomination, Mitt Romney would have been the nominee in 2008, and Phil Graham would have been the nominee in 1996. So you have to keep an eye on money because candidates have to be able to fund their campaigns and pay people on the ground. That's what messed up the Walker campaign, but money isn't everything.
Well, Ben, Trump has said this before. He said it last night that he is funding his own campaign. Do you think the Trump show is beginning to show some wear and tear?
I don't think so after last night's debate. So I've been kind of a contrarian skeptic when it comes to all the predictions of Donald Trump's balloon going out. I do think that there is probably no better analog for his campaign than that out-of-control billion-dollar blimp at 16,000 feet. But I do think that this is a situation where Trump is a guy who has soared over the heads of everybody else in this race because of his ability to communicate. And what we see is actually a situation where if you were having more debates, if you were having more frequent debates, then I think you could see some of these other candidates rise. Carly Fiorina, someone like that, really suffers because of the fact that they're having fewer debates this time around than they did in 2012. But it enables Trump. It actually goes to his benefit because he's someone who can get free media better than anyone else. And so you have this conversation, these various other voices and faces rise during the course of a conversation about a performance in a debate, and then you move away from that debate, and it's just Trump, 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 and all the media the conversation. Trump says he's funding his own campaign. He's actually accepting donations, and he is getting quite a lot of them. But I do think that this is a situation where, for Trump, you know, the deciding factor in terms of whether he stays in this race or not is probably whether he's bored with the process or not. You know, when he gets bored, when he gets disinterested, it is going to, you know, kind of be the case when he's not leading all the polls. We saw a little bit of that prior to the debate because of the polls from Iowa and a couple of national ones that show Ben Carson ahead. It was interesting to see Trump's response. It wasn't to lash out at Carson so much as it was to lash out at Iowa to say, hey, what did I do wrong? You
right.
know, aren't I great? Don't you want to come along and be great with me? Which is kind of an interesting thing. It's a little bit like negging in the sense of trying to win somebody back by running them down a little bit. And I think that this is a situation where for Trump, you know, the difference between Trump and these other candidates is that I think most of these other candidates understand that polls are not all that reliable of a measure of voter support, particularly in a situation like Iowa, where we've seen candidates like Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum dramatically overperform their expectations. Ben Carson's people in Iowa look like those voters. They don't look like the people who don't show up, who don't vote in primaries. Those are the people who currently back Donald Trump. The people who are backing Ben Carson look like the people who show up in the winter in Iowa, who stand in gymnasiums for 8 hours and make the case for their candidate, which is an indication that Trump's support is less solid than people might necessarily think. It may take, again, with Trump, just as it does with Bush, to the point of getting where people actually have to come out and vote for him to realize that this situation is not one where he is leading as much as he thinks he is.
And Sean, we're almost up in a break here, but it seems as if Trump takes polls very personally.
He takes a lot of things very personally. But look, I kind of disagree a little bit with Ben here. I think Trump's problem is that he's actually starting to sound like a candidate. And I think part of why you start to see this dip in the polls is he doesn't sound like the Donald Trump that we heard back in August. He's a little more scripted now. He actually seems a little bit bored with the process. I personally think we've reached peak Trump. I don't think we're going to see him drop out anytime soon, though.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversations, with Sean Trendy and Ben Domenech. And we are talking about last night's GOP presidential debate. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. In fact, it's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, talking about last night's presidential debate among the Republican candidates. And our guests are Sean Trendy. He's senior elections analyst for RealClearPolitics.com, Ben Domenech, publisher of The Federalist, also a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499 and weigh in with your reaction to last night's debate. Sean, let me put this to you, and I'd just like to ask a couple of questions about Ben Carson, because I have to say, watching him answer questions, especially in a debate format, and especially even last night, because he's now considered to be the front runner, or certainly a front runner in some of these states, I just get nervous when he's answering questions because I'm not sure he's going to be able to get to the end of the sentence. I worry about that. I'm not being insulting or facetious here. It makes me nervous.
Yeah, I sometimes last night I wonder if he was going to fall asleep. I'll be honest, I do not understand the Ben Carson appeal. I get Trump, you know, I get all the other candidates who have kind of surged and declined. But, you know, I think there is an appeal to Carson's affect and approach that is just kind of to the opposite type of person of myself. Someone on Twitter kind of described that Ben Carson appeals to your grandmother who sends out cards. And I think that's right. He's just a very nice man. He seems very honest. He talks in kind of these soothing tones, and that has an appeal to people who aren't necessarily watching this to get every policy step along the way.
Well, I don't know how many grandmothers make Nazi references, but but Ben, yeah. I mean, he makes a lot of Nazi references about slavery, about abortion. I mean, you know, these are references that have consequences.
But in these debates, he holds back from that, and I think that's important. Yeah. Most of his public opinion appearances don't have that.
Go ahead, Ben.
I think this is a situation where, you know, you have a candidate who really appeals to a lot of Americans, not just based on what he has to say, but based on his biography and how it fulfills or responds to various critiques that have been lodged against Republicans over and over again over the course of the past decade in the media and elsewhere. Ben Carson is someone who is, you know, has a biography that on issues of race, on issues of religion, on issues of intelligence, really responds to these critiques from the left, critiques that say that the Republican Party is full of racists, of religious bigots, or of people who are not very bright. He literally is an up from the bottom, a black, brilliant neurosurgeon who has accomplished amazing things within that field. And I think that that person who has a deep and abiding faith is what these voters are responding to currently. I think it has very little to do with the policies that he actually supports, because I think those policies are very thin. Mm. And I think that his knowledge of that is very shallow in terms of his ability to talk about them and defend them. It's one of the reasons why I was actually hoping in this debate we would have a little bit more from Carson and from Trump, particularly in terms of their economic plans. It's fine to speak in these very general terms, but we really didn't get to hear about that. I would have liked to hear Ben Carson answer a question about trade. I'm not sure what his opinion is of that. I'm not sure that he has an opinion. And unless you have those kinds of questions asked in these forums, it's very easy for candidates these days to generally avoid such kinds of challenges. I think that Carson is benefiting from that situation.
Sean, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think the point that Ben makes about his personality and his biography is right, and it all kind of fits together to this persona that is very calm, very reassuring. Maybe not so deep on policy, but at least at this point in the GOP process, I don't think that's what a lot of voters are looking for. So,
Sean, and I'd like to hear from you as well, Ben, talking about Governor Christie's performance. I asked that, of course, New Jersey in our listening area here. He does an interesting thing at these debates, which is he looks into the camera. And I don't think a lot of the other candidates didn't do that. But, Sean, what was your takeaway from what Governor Christie said last night?
Yeah, I always thought that he was of the one candidates who could debate their way out of getting 2 or 3% in the polls, he was probably the one who was most likely to do it. And I think we're going to get a test of that right now. I thought he had a very strong debate performance. He did a good job pushing back on the moderators without necessarily being overboard. He gave some good, sharp responses to some of the questions that were thrown his way. I think that probably Cruz and Rubio were the winners, but I would put Christie a pretty close third.
What about for you, Ben?
You know, I think I would agree with that. I think Carson I would probably put ahead of Christie and possibly Trump, just from the perspective that neither of them made mistakes that would damage their standing in terms of you know, stumbling over issues of policy or something like that. But I do think that Christie had a very solid performance. He, you know, it's interesting. there's been a general trend over the course of the past couple of years, something that's been backed by the Koch brothers, but certainly something that has also taken hold both among the libertarian factions, the Republican Party, and elsewhere, in favor of criminal justice reform, in favor of adapting to a situation where people generally are of the mindset that too many nonviolent criminals are in prison for long periods of time, that it's had a negative impact on families, particularly urban families. Chris Christie kind of represents the law and order candidate in this cycle, which has a lot of appeal for a party and for a country generally that believes that crime is becoming a major issue again. There's been a lot of recent polling indicating that people are of the mindset that crime and violent crime is on the rise. It's actually not.
That's right.
There are sort of pockets where it is, but generally in the country it is not. And that kind of takes you into this late 70s mindset where Republicans can offer this law and order, we'll lock the bad guys up and protect the suburbs kind of message. I think that Chris Christie sounded that note a couple of times last night and certainly could be somebody who could benefit from sending that message to a party that is open to hearing it.
Another thing, and Sean, I'll put this to you. Christie certainly complained about the government, in the sense sort of the government is the problem here. We're 3 years on when Hurricane Sandy blew into New Jersey and really destroyed a lot of that state. Governor Christie didn't have any problem calling the government for help. How do you understand the kind of, I guess, ambivalence that Republicans have with government?
You know, I think it's kind of gets back to the old question that they used to pose to Ron Paul all the time, which is that, you know, you say you oppose earmarks and these special appropriations that you vote for them. And his response was always, well, I would love to do away with it altogether, but as long as this money is being doled out there, I'm going to make sure my district gets the fair share. And that's the kind of bind that a lot of Republicans are in. They don't necessarily want a lot of these government programs, but just abstaining doesn't do anything for you and actually would put you in a hole with the voters. With that said, it was kind of tone deaf in that situation to say, you know, I don't like the government, but, you know, Hurricane Sandy was a huge government relief for New Jersey. So there's a tension there, but it's a hard one for Republicans to get out of. I don't think Christie would have improved his poll standing at all if he'd just turned down all the Sandy aid.
Or talked about hugging the president. I know that got him in trouble when Sandy blew into town, if I can say that. That's Sean Trendy. He's senior elections analyst for RealClearPolitics.com. Wrote a book called The Lost Majority. Also with us is Ben Domenech. He's a publisher of The Federalist, writes The Transom, and is a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. And like me and the Radio Times producers, we watched last night's Republican debate, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of ballot talks on Radio Times. And we want to get your impressions. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We played that Kasich clip at the very beginning. And Sean, he was working really hard to, get noticed last night and to offer, I think, a very different message for the Republicans who will be voting in the primary. Do you think it worked?
No, he seems to be running the John Huntsman campaign from 2012 of kind of hectoring conservatives in his party and calling them, you know, everything but the Star Wars cantina. It didn't work for Huntsman. And if anything, Kasich's view seems to be that the problem with the Huntsman campaign was Huntsman wasn't angry enough. There's a way to do what he's trying to do to set up distinctions between yourself and the rest of the party, to try to appeal to establishment moderate Republicans, because there are a lot of those that vote in primary campaigns. Mm. But calling everyone else on the stage, you know, he didn't call them cartoon villains, but he set up the question nicely, is just not the way to go about this.
Was he ranting, Ben?
You know, so John Kasich is a guy who's out of step with his party in a lot of different ways. He has not just accepted the Obamacare Medicaid expansion in Ohio. He has championed it as something that he believed was required by his faith. And something that he's put forward again and again in terms of contrasting himself with other candidates. The problem is he's just, you know, he is to the left of everyone else on that stage. And the moderators came back to him more than they came to other candidates in a way that was very obvious. He ended up speaking the third or fourth longest, depending on which measure you trust in terms of the timing. That, to me, was representative of the fact that they were kind of using him against the other candidates on stage, to Sean's point. But I don't think that he's going to see any real boost coming out of this. He's been saying basically the same message over and over again in terms of being the architect of this a budget deal that happened so long ago that people don't really remember it. And I think that in terms of his desperation right now, it's that he's seen his numbers drift down in the one state he's been spending time in, New Hampshire. He had previously in September announced that he wanted to play more in Iowa, and then he spent the entire month of October, and he has not set foot in the state. So I think this is a situation where, as Sean said, this is like the John Huntsman campaign. Mm-hmm. It's just with a guy who isn't as nice and who doesn't have as many pretty daughters around him.
Well, interesting comment there. But what's interesting? No, that's okay. I'll let that pass. Let me play another clip from last night, and this is Texas Senator Ted Cruz criticizing the line of questioning coming from the CNBC's moderators.
You know, let me say something at the outset. The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media. This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
Play very well with the audience. Sean, how would you say Ted Cruz did last night?
You know, I thought he had a very strong debate. The first two debates, I was actually kind of surprised at how poorly he did. Part of it is that he has, as he said at the beginning, he's not necessarily someone you'd want to go have a beer with. but he seems to have warmed up some. And I think that played a big role. He clearly has his finger on the pulse of the Republican Party base. He knows how to deliver a smooth attack, like you just said. I mean, rattling off four or five questions that he just heard is on a debate stage is a lot harder than you would think sitting in the audience. I think he's going to improve his stock, and I think there's a very good chance we're heading towards a Rubio-Cruz finale in this this primary process.
Oh, interesting. Do you see how this ends, Ben, as you look ahead? Who, based on last night and your reading of the tea leaves, who might be the candidate?
Well, I've been saying now for a couple of months that I think that Ted Cruz is the candidate best positioned to become the nominee, and that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, this time around, the establishment has not united around one candidate. Second of all, of the outsider candidates, he is the one that has the resume that looks the most presidential in terms of his background. He has the second most small dollar donors in the race, the second most cash on hand, and he's someone who I think is very well positioned in terms of heading into the actual voting. This was the first debate where I felt that he had a very strong performance. As Sean said, I think that he was very soft and kind of muted in the prior debates. This time around, I felt like he knocked virtually every question out of the park and really solidified his position as a leader for the conservative movement. What's most impressive about what he's been able to do is he's been able to push into the Rand Paul libertarian turf in a significant way. Rand is suffering so much more because of a situation where Ted has been able to steal his supporters in Iowa and other early states, and I think that that's going to continue. I think that Ted Cruz is the odds-on favorite to be the nominee, but the question is, you know, can the establishment unite around an alternative candidate? The establishment wants that candidate to be Rubio, I think, at this point. But as long as Jeb Bush is in the race, as long as John Kasich is in the race, and probably as long as Carly Fiorina is in the race, there is not really enough support going toward Rubio yet to really make him pop in these early states. I think that's going to be a challenge for him, and I think it's really a question of whether this process sorts through itself quickly enough in order for either candidate, Cruz or Rubio, to benefit.
Let me get Suma from Princeton to join our conversation. Suma, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. My observation is that that the last night debate seems to be the beginning to the end of the Jeb Bush campaign, especially when he failed to respond back to Rubio's answer to his own attack on Rubio. And secondly, Donald Trump seemed to have stole the show, but not for anything specific that you can take home for the general elections. Among all the contenders, the one I see that can possibly win the general election is Kasich, but Kasich has no traction. The rest of them, they're just talking big noise, but when it comes to general election, all of them will lose against Hillary. That's my opinion.
Okay, Suma, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to add to that, Sean? I mean, I don't know if it's too soon to, to ring the or just to say this is the end of the Bush campaign. And let me just ask you why the establishment has been so much in his camp, in his corner. What do they like about him?
Well, I think they started out just liking the fact that he was a Bush. I think part of it was by default. They didn't like the other candidates who were coming out of the sort of establishment wing of the party. As far as whether it's the end, I think you are going to see a lot of people closing up their checkbooks and going elsewhere, and that's going to hurt. But at this point, Bush does have enough money to make it to the voting. Unless he's just so frustrated that he gives up, I don't think he's going to give up until, he has poor showings in Iowa and or New Hampshire, if that happens.
And Ben, about a minute before our second break here, what about Carly Fiorina?
I think Carly had a pretty solid performance. It wasn't the home run that it was in her prior debate. But again, I think Carly is someone who, she's interesting in the sense that she cuts across both the outsider and the insider line. She has kind of a more insider resume, but is someone who appeals to a lot of the outsiders. Of all of the people on the stage, she's the one person who I think could potentially be a vice presidential choice for a couple of different people in terms of others. I think most of the others would probably go to somebody who's not currently in the race.
She concluded by saying, I may not be your favorite candidate to the audience, but I'm Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare.
I think there is some truth to the fact that she's dramatically improved as a debater, but I think that appeal is something that's pretty limited. It's not necessarily what you want when you're choosing a presidential nominee, simply someone who's going to debate the other person. If that was true, then last time they would have picked Newt Gingrich.
And that's Ben Domenech, who joins us along with Sean Trendy in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And we're talking about last night's GOP presidential debate. And we want to hear from you. Looks like we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Also, emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I'm talking with Sean Trendy, Senior Elections Analyst for RealClearPolitics.com, author of a book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. Also with us is Ben Domenech. He's publisher of The Federalist, writes The Transom, and he's a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. And we watched last night's GOP debate, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of the show. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Warren who says, why were they so hard on big business last night? I thought Republicans were the party of big business. Doesn't big business provide most of the revenue, even if it's not enough? Ben, do you think they were hard on business last night?
I'm not sure that I think that they were hard on business so much as they were sounding a lot of populist notes as it relates to business policies. I do think that Carly Fiorina had a pretty strong answer to the question of government-mandated leave and retirement benefits. But I also think that in this current context, there's certainly an awareness on the part of Republicans that business, particularly big business, has become an institution that has really accrued a lot of distrust among the American people over the course of the past several years. It's been viewed as a time when big business has profited and small businesses have struggled, and that this is something that is due not just to economic decisions in terms of the marketplace, but due to government policy. I think that sounding the note that as president, a lot of these people tried to do, that they would change those policies as it regards as it regards banks, as it regards lending practices, as it regards the general regulatory burden on small businesses. I think that that's a real note of consistency among most Republicans these days, and is something that we're going to hear of hear more from whoever ends up being the nominee.
I mean, there was a
Can
fair.
I jump in
yeah,
on
go
that
ahead,
real
Sean.
Quick?
Yes. Please.
Yeah, there's a strain in conservatism, really dating back at least to Jackson, that kind of views one of the critiques of big government as being that it inherently gets into bed with business, and there's a interest group capture and a whole bunch of theory that goes along with it. There's a movement that's been percolating the last 3 or 4 years among the grassroots, the so-called reformicons, who have really sought to incorporate that critique of corporate welfare and the relationship between government and business. I thought it was fascinating to see so many candidates sounding those notes last night.
And that's the kind of vulture capitalism that Newt Gingrich was talking about in previous races?
Exactly. I mean, you can see this thread really going back to the House Revolution of the 90s, and like I said, in conservatism well before that. But it's really taking shape within the Republican Party, and there are a lot of writers like Jay Cost and Ben, quite frankly, who have sought to kind of bring this critique to the forefront, especially in light of the way that a lot of Obama's initiatives, like Obamacare, have emerged as a partnership between large corporate entities and the government.
Ben, let me ask you about flat tax. And that was a number of the candidates said that they supported a flat tax. There was a question about 10%. Ben Carson talked about tithing 10% or 15%. And I guess the question is, do the numbers add up? And are any of these candidates really willing to make the serious cuts that you'd have to make in order to have a relatively low flat tax?
So you got directly to the point there, which is that the tax plans actually matter a little less than how you actually pay for them. it's the tax plans from Republicans vary in a lot of different ways. Some of them are better than others. I've talked to Larry Kudlow and others about this on my own radio show, and it's a situation where there's a lot to like in terms of these various plans you have in Carson's side. A purer traditional flat tax. You have in Jeb Bush and in Marco Rubio different approaches when it comes to taxation. I do think that one of the core questions is kind of how much you use the tax code to try to help families. Mm-hmm. This has been a key point of debate in terms of how best to do that. Is it by giving them a larger child tax credit? Is it by doing other things? Rand Paul talked about getting rid of the payroll tax and shifting it in a significant way, which would obviously lower taxes for every working American. I think that the real hard question, though, is not where you think the brackets ought to be, who you think ought to benefit in this stage. It's more, how are you going to pay for it? Is it going to be a situation?
Whoops, we seem to have lost Ben Domenech. Do we still have you, Sean Trendy?
I'm still here.
Okay, I won't make you answer or finish the answer that he had there, but we'll get Ben back on the line. Let me just read something else here. I'll put this to you, Sean, because you're the only one left so far. Question from Carol. She says, is the fact that Ted Cruz was born in Canada a problem for the Republican Party? And I think she's referencing the questions about President Obama, who was born in the United States but had a father from Kenya.
Yeah, I'm no expert on citizenship and birthright citizenship. My understanding is that if you're born to American citizens abroad, you're still an American citizen. There is some question about it with respect to John McCain being born in the Panama Canal Zone in 2008, and it went away quickly. There's a different way you can interpret that question, though, which is, if this comes out, does this bother Republican primary voters? And I think, since there was a large segment that was willing to buy into birtherism and seems to have some distrust, at least, of a non-white candidate with ties to people being born abroad, I think there is a segment of the Republican base that will be turned off when that kind of comes to light.
What's so interesting to me is Donald Trump, spent a lot of time digging into Barack Obama and the president's birth certificate, sent people apparently to Hawaii. And when asked about it more recently, sort of what did he come up with? His answer was, oh, that's ancient history.
Yeah, I mean, for someone who really follows the ins and outs of these things, I mean, that was pretty jarring, you know. I mean, the foray into birtherism is one of the reasons I went into this with kind of an instinctive dislike of Donald Trump. For the average voter that doesn't really, you know, that thinks about politics once every 4 years, he said that's ancient history and that's probably good enough. That was probably the right political play to make, even if you and I grimaced.
Well, let me get Joseph from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. And Joseph, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello.
Hi there.
It's a pleasure to hear you talk about politics that isn't centered on who are you for or who are you against. My question is about the political process. Do you think it's still possible, as let's say with Ronald Reagan in 68 and then in 76 and 80, for a candidate to run, not be nominated, get exposure, and then run in another 4 or 8 years? Or is that time passed? You have to, is it like a rocket that goes off and then it fades away?
Well, let me take your question, and I might just change it slightly because I have a question. And Ben, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. What about these candidates that are at the sort of low levels, even the, what do they call it, the JV debate? Why? I mean, if you're at 0 or 1 or 2 or 3%, even with a margin of error, why do they keep running?
Well, I'm not going to get into the head of George Pataki and try to explain what he's really doing here in terms of psychological analysis. But I will tell you that there are a couple different motivations. Lindsey Graham really ran this time because he holds strong opinions about the need for interventionist foreign policy. The presumption at the time that he got in was that Rand Paul would be doing a lot better. And Graham, I think, got in part in order to be on the debate stage to debate Rand Paul. Now, it's turned out he hasn't been able to get enough numbers to even get on stage with Rand. I think he's hoping to have kind of an opportunity to do that if Rand's numbers continue to drop. But that was the reason he ran. Bobby Jindal looked like a pretty competitive guy early on before we saw Ben Carson take on. He's in kind of the same lane in Iowa of being a guy who has a lot of populist appeal among social conservatives. The problem is that he's the second or third choice for them as opposed to, compared to Carson, Huckabee, people like that. His campaign operation is very lean. It's one of these situations where, you know, these guys do not have big operations designed to get them elected. But it's kind of a situation now where, you know, what else is Rick Santorum going to do at this stage in his career?
Oh, wow.
You might as well run for president. It's it's better than the alternative.
We've come to that in our politics, Ben.
You know, we have to a certain degree. It's about getting your name out there, getting recognition for you and for your career. And sometimes I actually think it's possible to turn runs like this into potentially being a cabinet member or getting a look at some other opportunity after this kind of stage. It is kind of silly, though, when you see people who are actually accomplished, people who have had long careers in the Senate or in government or in foreign policy, you know, in this kind of junior level discussion. I actually think what would be better, kind of to Sean's point earlier in the show about the difficulty of handling so many people on stage, I think it would be better to kind of cut these in half, to send maybe Chris Christie and Rand and John Kasich to the undercard debate. It would make for a more interesting debate in both senses, I think, if you had it kind of split that way, as opposed to the current situation where, you know, these four guys don't really have the kind of back and forth with other serious presidential candidates that would lead to a productive debate in terms of learning about them, giving them an opportunity to shine and maybe make their way up in the polls.
Let me get, looks like Dick from Langhorne to join us. Hi, Dick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Very interesting debate. What I don't see being discussed, particularly in terms of the Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio possible winning of the primary, is how these guys are going to fare in a general election. The midterms, very slow turnout. The Republicans did well. Hillary is probably going to turn out a humongous number of voters who did not vote in the Republican sweep of 2014. And a lot of those are people that have to be attracted. Democrats only represent 36% of the electorate. Republicans only 26 to 28. And there's 44% that's not registered either party. And I don't see either Cruz or Rubio or anybody except maybe some of the establishment candidates having the cachet with those voters who are basically going to make the difference.
Well, Dick, that's an interesting question. I'm going to toss that to Sean Trendy.
Yeah, I'm going to make a quick comment on what Ben just said, though, about Jindal. You know, just for perspective, Jindal is 6 points out of fifth place right now and 4 points out of fifth place in Iowa. It would that's why they're staying in, is that it doesn't take a huge shift for them to suddenly appear in the top five or six. But as to the point of, how Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio fares, I am a fundamentals guy. I'm someone who believes that presidential elections, general elections, are generally dictated by the job approval of the president and the state of the economy. And so I absolutely think Marco Rubio or even Ted Cruz could defeat Clinton in the right circumstances. I think, you know, the point about the independent voters who are going to turn out in large numbers in the general election is a good one. But these are also voters who aren't as tuned into policy, who are more into biography and personal appeal and so forth. And so I think that someone like Marco Rubio, who has a very nice affect about him, could do surprisingly well with these voters.
Ben, let me put an email from Rob to you. He says, how can the same people talking about a flat tax support capping the FICA tax for rich people? That would solve Social Security's problems.
You know, that's an interesting question in terms of, Social Security seems to keep coming back up in these debates. It seems surprising to me because that's a situation where it's really just a math problem about the fact that we have people living longer, and because of that, we need to adjust our expectation for at what point Social Security kicks in. You can do that with just a mild increase of the degree to which we think people ought to be working to about 67, 68. The thing that I think is interesting about what Sean just said is I think he's completely right. I think this is a scenario where Hillary Clinton is a flawed candidate running to replace a two-term president who is not particularly popular. What we've seen in the past is situations where flawed candidates both won elections in the case of George H.W. Bush and lost elections in the case of Al Gore. I think this could really go either way, and the potential nominees for the party matter maybe a little bit less than a lot of the prognosticators think in terms of their ability to appeal across traditional lines.
Well, it is a very fluid race, I think, looking broadly and broadly speaking. Do you, Sean, is there too much focus on Iowa and what people in Iowa think about candidates? They have a caucus, which is unusual. We don't have caucuses here in Pennsylvania, and it's a largely white state, which is very different from a lot of states in this country.
Yeah, there's an old saying that Iowa picks corn and New Hampshire picks presidents.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth. I mean, you look at the people who have won Iowa the past few cycles. It's Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. It's a state where Pat Robertson came in ahead of George H.W. Bush in 1988. It's a strange electorate. The reason that we focus in on it is just that it's the first real chance we get to see how voters respond to these candidates. It does a good job of winnowing people down who get, a sixth of a point or whatever. At the same time, I don't see, unless you're someone like Rick Santorum, who's absolutely banking on Iowa, maybe Bobby Jindal, I don't think you're going to see the same type of winnowing we saw in the past. I think that's going to hold off until after New Hampshire or maybe even South Carolina.
Ben, I'm giving you the last word. You got 40 seconds. Go ahead.
I agree with Sean when it comes to Iowa's influence. It has an outsized influence compared to the kind of people it actually represents. I think over the past couple of years, that influence has been diminished as people have seen that it is not particularly representative of what the country as a whole thinks about things, certainly about the issue of ethanol and that kind of taxpayer support for that practice. But I do think that this time around, it could have a winnowing effect, and there is going to be some concern among people if they do not come in the top three. This is a very fluid election, as you said before, and Iowa, I think, is going to have an effect on maybe boosting the opportunities of some of these outsider candidates.
That was 40 seconds. Ben Domenech, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
And he's the publisher of The Federalist. He writes The Transom and the senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. Sean Trendy, thank you very much for joining us on Ballot Talks and Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And he's a senior elections analyst for RealClearPolitics.com, wrote a book called The Lost Majority. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, and listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.